Okay.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to our afternoon's seminar. Before I introduce our two speakers, I would like to invite you, please, to introduce yourself. Say who you are, where you're from, and why are you here today? So, would you like me to start us off?
Mayor Hillman from Policy Studies Institute. I'm here because I am at one with Sean and David on seeing what we can do when we're failing lamentably to influence public policy, not just in this country but around the world.
That's fantastic. Thank you.
Sean Clayton, Princeton Foundation for Built Environment. I guess I've got a background some time ago in the Australian climate change and our carbon trading scheme.
I'll give you a moment to get your breath. Sorry, which transition town?
Highbury.
Visualize complexity. I'll need to talk to you about that later. Yes,
well, I do a little visualization.
Yes, you do. A different type of visualization,
yes.
Yeah.
I work with Eve on several projects at London School of Complexity Group. I write nature-based simulations and the visualization of. I'm hoping to do social complex systems such as transition towns, might be very interesting. So.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm Matt Scott, graduate of economics and LSE, interested in tradable energy politics.
I'm Anna Podowski from Peckham Power, which is a community-led energy infrastructure project, and formerly also Peckham Carbon Rationing Action Group, so I have a strong interest in techs.
I'm David Fleming, and I'm going to be talking to you about tradable energy projects.
I'm Tom, like Matilda, I'm from the ecologists. I've come to see if the debate's moved on at all over the past half year or so.
I'm Vic Henney from the Global Solutions Initiative, I've come here to learn a little bit about the reality of what the transition towns are coming, and I'm particularly interested to see what David Fleming's been doing, because I've been following his work for the last 10 years.
How wonderful. Great.
It's a good bloke.
Definitely. Okay, and I'm Eve Middleton-Kelly. I'm the director of the Complexity Research Programme here at the London School of Economics, and we organise this series of seminars. And just to let you know, this is part of a bigger picture, because ESRC funded us to do 6 seminars. The last one is on the reverse of your sheet, which is next week on the 8th of July. We still have just a very few places, so if you're interested, do register with Raoul. What we're really trying to do is to look at the application of complexity theory in different areas of application, and energy and climate change seems to have been the most popular. So we've had quite a few seminars on energy and climate change. What we have today is Sean Chamberlain and Dr. Devin Fleming, who will talk to us about transition towns and tradable energy quotas. And I would like to first of all introduce both our speakers. Then the format is going to be Sean will start, we'll have a little discussion, David will give the second presentation, another discussion, then we'll have a break for tea, and then we'll see how many questions you've got, whether to carry on with, again, a discussion, or whether to have you discuss some specific questions which the speakers have prepared. Sean is really quite an amazing fellow. He is the author of Transition Timeline. And for those of you who know anything about the Transition Initiative, I think you could not help but actually have come across his book, because what it does, it lays out very much the transition approach and vision. Beyond that, he's also advisor to DEC on personal carbon allowances, and he has a website, darkoptimism.org, which again is a wonderful resource. Now, I asked Sean what brought him to this topic, and I think it's a rather fascinating story, because after university, he became involved with a learning center for under 16 asylum seekers. He was on night duty, and he kept hearing these astonishing stories of these young people. He also, so some were asylum seekers, some were heroin addicts, and so on. And from that, he went on, because he was helping them to reintegrate into society. But then the question arose, what kind of society? When he became aware about peak oil. So, in 2006, he met David at a course at Schumacher College, and that's how the two came together. And in March 2009, he published his book. David, when I asked him the same question, he went back to 1996 when he actually wrote an article on energy, on tradable energy quotas. So he really does go back a long time with this idea. He was a columnist on transport, and he wrote the article. And very much a lot of the logic has not actually changed in all this. It's just that now it has become so much more relevant and important, and we really do need to think about it much more thoroughly. His next project, in fact, something he's been working on for the past 20 years, is the next book that's coming out called Lean Logic, A Dictionary of the Future and How to Survive It. I think, again, it sounds more than just fascinating. It's a resource that I think most of us will be able to use, and he calls it a resource to both enable and empower. So welcome to both our speakers. And Sean, if you would like to switch your little microphone on and go ahead, that will be lovely. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I should also mention, on the same course where I met David, I also met Rob Hopkins for the first time back in 2006, who was the founder of the transition movement that was just sort of kicking off down in Totnes at the time. And so that was something that also I've been involved with since then. So yeah, I'm going to be talking mainly about the transition towns concept and what it's about. And I think this slide sums up beautifully what it's about. It's about a vision of our future which just makes us want to leap out of bed in the morning and get on with making it happen, a really positive, realistic, exciting vision of what our future could be like. And a lot of my work now focuses around visions of the future. And these are extremely important and extremely powerful, because they shape all our decisions and all our approaches to things. It's why we use stories to educate our children. It's why politicians tell stories to win our votes or to scare us into voting for them. But visions can be very dangerous as well, because some of the dominant stories in our culture are misleading in some ways. So, for example, the vision of our future, which says that scientific progress will overcome all, that there is no limit to human ingenuity, is very dangerous if that encourages us not to engage with problems and to trust that, you know, they will sort it out, whoever they might be. So I think when we're visioning the future, it's important, if you like, to be unrealistic, certainly in terms of social changes, in terms of realising that radical change can and does happen, and that actually everything staying exactly the same is totally unrealistic. So it's important to be sort of socially unrealistic, yet grounded in realism about those things that we can't change, things like the laws of thermodynamics. They're not going to cease to apply, much as we might wish it so. So transition's starting point, really, is taking our positive story of the future and grounding it in a reality check. And the big issues that shape that reality check, that really shape our future, energy depletion and peak oil. And as Eve mentioned, we've had talks in this series from Chris Martinson of the Crash Course, who talked a lot about peak oil, from David Wasdell of the Apollo Gaia Project, who talked a lot about climate change. So I'm not going to go into great detail on these, but if you want to, those lectures are available on the Complexity Group's website. You can listen to them in full there, but a lot of you won't have been there. This graph, I think, really sums up the peak energy situation nicely. So on this graph, we've got this quantified in megatons of oil equivalent per annum. So this is energy flow rate per year, and this is oil, coal, and natural gas. So this is the main fossil fuels, and the present is about here. So this is available energy, both known and predicted discoveries from fossil fuels over the coming decades, and it's based on, without going into detail, some research that I consider to be about the best available. And we can see that, give or take, we're roughly at the peak of energy availability from the main fossil fuels, and we're facing this energy decline. And the other important thing to realise about this graph is that this is energy availability. Of course, if we're going to deal with climate change, we can't possibly afford to use all of that fossil fuel. And so the descent slope is going to be that much steeper. And the reason this matters, of course, is that energy is probably best defined as our ability to do stuff. It's not just a transport issue, it's a food issue, it's a communications issue, it's a healthcare issue. And so this is a real huge challenge facing our culture and our society. And the UK picture, this is our oil and gas combined, which peaked back in 1999, so over a decade ago now, and is now down to almost half those levels. And just last week, the Department of Energy and Climate Change published its Energy Trends paper, which showed that for the first quarter of this year, as compared to the first quarter of last year, oil production's down, natural gas production's down, coal production's down 12.5%, and total energy production down 6.5%, and indeed wind, hydro, and other renewable energies electricity supply down 6.5%, and hydro down massively, 44%, because of the lower rainfall that we've had over the last few months. So the bottom line here, since 2000, which as we saw is about when our oil and gas peaked, despite all the renewables, everything else that's going on, UK primary energy production is down almost 50% over the last 10 years. Meanwhile, gas demand is up, electricity consumption's up, final energy consumption's up, and net gas imports, which is what we're making up a lot of the gap up with, up 46% on a year ago. And our annual energy deficit in 2008, which are the last figures available, was 57.5 million tonnes of oil equivalent. So again, that's a measure of energy content. And the cost of importing those is estimated at about £10 billion per year. And as Chris Hune admitted last week, joining the chorus of people admitting this, the era of cheap energy is over. That's our new Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change. So to put that in graphic form, this is the energy balance of the UK. The blue line is our indigenous production, and the red line is our energy demand. And you can see that we've gone from being a net energy exporter to being, again, a net energy importer, like we were before the discovery of North Sea oil and gas. And this graph is a very similar graph with a bit more detail, but basically looking to the future, these are three demand scenarios looking forward, and this is predicted domestic energy supply. And we know this pretty well because these projects are already happening. If a project's going to be supplying us with energy in the next decade, it's pretty much got to have started already. So this is the huge energy gap, and we're already spending $10 billion a year on that gap. This graph was produced a couple of years ago, hence our previous chancellor. This is the income surplus we were gaining from exporting oil and gas, and this is the deficit we're moving into. We're currently about here on oil and gas as our domestic production plummets and our consumption continues to increase. Now, of course, many of us will be aware that the UK economy was in an absolute state before discovery of North Sea oil and gas, and it's been bailed out by a combination of the North Sea and the financial sector. So I'd like to say that things are looking pretty rosy for the future. So in brief on peak energy, there is no simple techno fix that's going to bail us out of this. There are many alternative energy options, but each has its limits and all require significant time and major investment. There is no silver bullet here. So depletion fundamentally means the bottom line. We must plan for a future of less energy. So when we're going back to our visions of the future, our positive visioning, it has to be about how do we build a better future that uses less energy than we currently use. The other big issue, of course, is climate change. I'm really not going to touch on this very much here because a lot of you will have heard it all before. Just a few quotes. Secretary General of the UN, slowing and reversing the threat of climate change is the defining challenge of our age. Sir David King, who was then the UK government's chief scientific advisor, delaying action for decades or even just years is not a serious option, and that was over 6 years ago now. Professor John P. Holdren, who's chairman of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and has recently been appointed President Obama's chief scientific advisor, said in 2006, "We've already passed the stage of dangerous climate change. The task now is to avoid catastrophic climate change." And Rajendra Pachauri, who's the chairman of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, "If there's no action before 2012, that's too late. What we do in the next 2 to 3 years will determine our future. This is the defining moment." And without going into details, the IPCC are understating the scale of the problem in various ways as well. So there's an absolutely overwhelming sense of urgency. The open question on climate change is it too late to do anything about it, full stop? Not how slowly can we get away with reducing emissions. Nonetheless, the politics on that are, as we all know, massively out of step with the science. It is the somewhat large elephant in the room. So what we get when we take our energy problem on the one hand and our climate challenge on the other hand is what I call the supply side dilemma. We get all these arguments between, say in the US Congress, we've got energy independence bills going through Congress, which are all about subsidising tar sands and coal to liquids in order to reduce dependence on foreign oil, which of course are an absolute disaster in terms of climate change. And then you've got climate change bills going through talking about all sorts of, frankly, ineffective ways of reducing carbon emissions. And they're totally at loggerheads. And there's been this real problem in policy that energy and climate change policy have tended to push directly against each other. And in Chris Huhne's speech last week, he completely failed to address that. He just said, oh, well, what we need is a low-carbon, high-energy future, and we need... He just ignored all the contradictions that are in there. So the climate change imperative, being as serious as it is, sort of suggests in itself that we should just ban all fossil fuel extraction today, i.e. further limit the supply, make that curve that we saw earlier of energy availability even steeper in an attempt to head off the worst of climate change. But of course, if we did that, if we seriously actually stopped fossil fuel extraction, it would cause completely unacceptable suffering because our entire infrastructure, our entire society is massively dependent on these sources of energy. So we've got this tension, this tightrope between the two, and renewables do help to loosen that, and we absolutely need all we can get, but they don't resolve it for us. They're not able to ramp up as quickly as fossil energy is going down. But there is one thing that helps on all fronts that gets us out of this dilemma, that gets us out of this problem, and that's reducing demand, recognising that actually there isn't a magical source of low-carbon energy out there. Nuclear fusion isn't going to bail us out of all our problems. Shale gas isn't going to bail us out of our problems. You know, whatever it is that's the latest, oh, don't worry, we've solved it, isn't going to solve all our problems. We actually have to recognise that we're coming up against limits of available low-carbon energy and reduce our demand for energy according to what's available. And that is the fundamental message of the climate and energy situations combined, is we have to reduce demand, we have to reduce our energy use, reduce our carbon use by reducing our demand for energy. which means the end of business as usual. I love this picture. My friend took this on the street. Brilliant. So we're often told with problems like this, large-scale problems require large-scale solutions. It's repeated so often, it almost seems like a truism. But I'm going to argue that it's completely wrong. My colleague, David Fleming there, the most brilliant thing he ever said, in my opinion, is that large-scale problems do not require large-scale solutions. They require small-scale solutions within a large-scale framework. And when I heard this back in 2006, it completely changed the course of my life, with no exaggeration. I was thinking I have to get involved in Kyoto and Copenhagen and all that big-level stuff. You know, that's where the real action's at. That's where I can really make a difference. But that's completely transformed now. I mean, obviously, climate change is the kind of problem where if we do our bit, someone else doesn't do their bit, we don't solve the problem. Clearly it is. So we do need international level agreement on carbon energy budgets. And obviously we do need to actually implement that at the national level as well, which is where we've been falling really short. You know, even if we got the dream agreement at Copenhagen, nobody would have believed it was actually going to happen, because again and again governments are missing their targets. David's going to talk about TETS, which is a way of addressing that. And then of course we've got the local level, things like the transition towns and a myriad of other brilliant examples from around the world of local level action. And one of the critical things about local level action is that it looks really different everywhere. Every place will have its own skills, its own resources, its own needs, its own people. And so you can't expect to have a sort of identikit thing that you can just plonk down in each community and it's going to work. That isn't how local level action succeeds. And of course, at the personal level and at the family level, we need to take responsibility and make changes ourselves. And I'd like to flip that upside down, because if we go back to this slide, there was these three little dashes here are, I think, really significant, because below those three dashes, that's where all the emissions come from. That's where all the energy demand comes from. That's where all the actual living comes from. That's where the people are. Everything up here, important though it is, only exists to stimulate change down here. If we've got the perfect agreement here and this wonderful policy here and nobody actually changed their life, we wouldn't have a solution to the problem. If everyone changed their life voluntarily and everything was completely hunky-dory, we wouldn't need this. So this is the real core. We need this to support and encourage that. So I like to flip the chart upside down, put the personal and the local up top, and then the national level stuff is a way of supporting that, not a way of implementing top-down things. And the international level is where we accept and embrace our collective responsibility for the changes that need to happen up here. So I'm now going to talk about this local level in transition, but bear in mind that it's within this broader framework. So transition initiatives, the transition approach, is a recognition that peak oil, climate change, economic contraction means that business as usual is not an option. And all transition work, first thing I should say about it, is that it carries a thing called a cheerful disclaimer, which is basically saying we don't have all the answers. Because sometimes you find people who've been trapped in sort of doom and gloom opinions about all this stuff, and they find transition, and they go, oh, thank God, you're going to tell me how to solve all this. Brilliant. We can't do that. The whole point of transition is there are these very real problems facing us all. Let's get together with our communities, talk about what those problems are, and think about how we can approach them. We don't have any more answers than anyone else, but we've got some tools that are useful for exploring the questions. So it's an adaptable process. As I mentioned, it will look very different in each community, and it certainly does. It's a creative process. Things emerge from it that you couldn't predict just by looking at the aspects of the system, of the approach. And it's positive, as I mentioned. It's all about saying, what kind of future do we want to create? Let's get on with doing it. And it's very much now. The Transition Network is a charity that was set up to support the various initiatives which are going through the transition process. And I'm now going to go through what we call the 12 steps of transition, which were laid out in Rob Hopkins' Transition Handbook, which we found is quite a good way of explaining transition. But we have found some problems with it, and I'll talk about that a little later as well. But beforehand, I'd just like to show who's actually doing this transition process. I hope you can make this out. This is a Google map with little indicators on it for each transition initiative. So you can see that Britain is covered in transition initiatives. And of course, this isn't all of them. This is just the ones who've bothered to go on and register and put themselves on the Google map. So there's a lot more than that going on. This is Europe, except for Britain. and the various initiatives that are spreading across Europe.
What's the difference in the colour?
Oh, now you're asking me. If I remember rightly, it's that the green are ones who have been through, basically they've been heavily in contact with the Transition Network. The Transition Network knows them, knows that they've got an initiating group or a steering group who are very competent and developed and have a good structure in place, that they've made contact with neighbouring groups, that they've got a decent number of members. So just ones that are quite involved and have, and we know that they're kind of up and running and kind of doing their thing. The blue ones are ones that have been in touch with Transition Network and said, you know, we're doing this stuff, but we need some help with this and this, and so they're kind of moving towards being green. And the red ones are the ones that have just sort of been in contact about, you know, we're quite interested in getting involved with Transition, but we haven't yet kind of got up and running. I think that's the basic colour coding. So yeah, that's Europe. This is North America and Canada and Mexico down there. And this is Australia and New Zealand, which has, for whatever reason, developed a great interest in it as well. I think partly because Richard Heinberg and David Holmgren did a speaking tour that went down the east coast of Australia, which might explain part of that. New Zealand, who knows. We often find that there's one will start somewhere, and then it just sort of spreads like some kind of virus, and which is quite exciting because we've got lots of places that have just got in touch. Particularly in South America, there seems to be a good, big upswelling of it in South America at the moment. We had, I think it was 8 women from Brazil came over to the Transition Conference a few weeks ago, and we're talking about the work they're doing there, which is quite exciting. So the 12 steps of transition that I mentioned earlier, the first is setting up an initiating group. So this is the first people in the community who think, wow, transition's an interesting idea, I'd like to explore that, I'd like to try and do it. And obviously they're the ones who have to lay the groundwork, get other people involved. But crucially, the demise of the initiating group is designed in from the outset, because lots of organisations of all kinds find that they struggle because the founders either lose interest and drift off, or are too dominating and don't let other people take it where it needs to go, or, you know, loads of problems with that. So the idea is that the initiating group does the early work, gets the sort of thing off the ground, but then, as we'll see a bit later, it dissolves itself and a steering group comes in to replace it. It's made up of representatives of the various working groups that we'll hear about in a minute. Step two, and again, these are not prescriptive steps, so it's not like you must do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. These are a set of tools that you might find useful, and, you know, pick from them and use them as you want in whatever order you want and take what works. Step two is awareness raising, which is building networks with natural allies in the community, so maybe other environmental campaigning groups or transport groups or whoever it might be, and doing lots of community awareness raising, so showing movies, doing talks and events to raise understanding of the issues that Transition is trying to grapple with, and also awareness raising of the new Transition initiative itself, and getting word out there so that people know that this thing's going on in their community. And step three we call laying the foundations, which is a kind of expansion of that, where you're looking at other groups, so maybe local religious groups, say, or any group locally that has a large constituency that, you know, has a sort of some say in the community, going to them and saying, you know, here we are, we've got this many members, we're doing this, how can we support what you're doing? How can we, you know, help with what you're doing? And becoming a sort of umbrella, if you like, for various things, so that, for example, in Kingston, where I'm from, we have a really strong group called the Kingston Cycling Campaign. So when we started, we went to them and said, how can we support? And they said, well, we'd love you to promote our events and tell your members about this and that. So we've done that. And then when we came to looking at the future of transport in Kingston, they've become a fantastic resource. So they're almost like our transport group, if you like, and they're very happy to be under this sort of umbrella of Transition Town Kingston that's developing locally. And also working with local council, things like that, which we'll talk about a bit more in a minute, and local businesses, any significant players in the local scene, really. And then step four, what we call organising a great unleashing, which is having a big event that feels like a sort of historic event, like a coming of age for the community. So in Kingston, we've been going about 2.5 years. We had our unleashing a few months ago because we felt like we'd sort of we'd built up a head of steam. People were really keen to get on to doing practical on the ground stuff. And we were sort of holding them back to kind of build up that steam. But then it felt like, well, if we hold on any longer, we're just, you know, that energy's going to start to dissipate. So it just felt like the right moment, and different communities do it at different parts in their proceeding. But for us, it was this fantastic event. We had the local mayor and the local MPs come and talk, and David Fleming, in fact, came and talked, and lots of community art projects went on, and lots of local organisations came and had stalls, and it was a really exciting event, and because it was right in the city, in the town centre, lots of people came through who'd never heard of Transition Town Kingston before and got involved with the back of that. And then out of that, forming working groups. So this is where people who have a particular interest in a particular area, so maybe someone's interested in food or in energy or in transport or whatever it is that's their interest, they get together with the people in the community who almost always are already doing this stuff, and you form a working group to look at, you know, how are we going to take this area forward in the context of the world that we were just looking at. Working with existing groups, organising training for people, you know, maybe if there's someone who's a real expert on something. We've got a guy in Kingston who's on the Government Renewables Advisory Board, for example, and so he's been doing a lot of work with us, sort of bringing us right up to speed with the latest developments in renewables. And then, as I say, once you've got some well-established working groups, at that point the steering group looks at dissolving itself, so that one representative from each of those working groups forms the new steering group. And that also means that those who are on the initiating group sort of get the weight taken off them as well. It means they can then go and get involved in their particular passion and don't have to be sort of holding the whole thing for forevermore. And I often find in transition communities that are just starting up, people find that very reassuring because they feel like, I'm quite keen to go with this, but I don't want to be left holding it forever. So the sense that it dissolves itself is in some ways reassuring to the initiating group as well. Open space is a tool that we use a lot in transition, which really shouldn't work, but it's basically, the idea is based on the concept that at conferences and things, the most useful and productive conversations are usually had in the coffee breaks. And so open space is kind of a way of creating a coffee break type environment for a meeting. I won't go into detail on how it works here, but it's a wonderful way of having a meeting with a large number of people and managing to sort of suck all the passion and expertise from them and expose it to the whole community, rather than just having, you know, one person at the front talking about an idea, actually managing to get everybody contributing and discussing. And a couple of books there that explain that in great detail, and there's a lot of stuff on the web on that. And a really critical thing about transition is early on developing visible, practical manifestations of the project. So doing things in the community that people can see happening and go, oh, you know, what's that? Who did that? Oh, Transition Town Kingston, that's interesting. And, you know, getting people to be able to feel what it's about rather than just hear what it's about and see what it's about. So the picture there is from Transition Town Totnes's nut tree planting program. They've been doing a huge nut tree planting program in Totnes because they want to build local food resilience as well as all the other benefits of tree planting. There are other communities who've done things like building court bus shelters to replace, you know, temporary tacky bus shelters or stops that didn't have one at all. There have been huge artworks done as monuments to the end of the age of oil in the town centre. A huge diversity of things depending on the sort of local character of the community, and lots of projects around food. I'll talk about some of the examples in a minute. But really getting dirt under your fingernails and making sure this doesn't become another sort of talking shop, making sure that this is actually based on doing things together. And tied in with that, facilitating what we call the great reskilling. Rob said once that we must be the most useless generation that's ever lived. Over the past couple of hundred years of fossil fuel dependency, we've forgotten so many of the skills that are going to be so useful to us in the energy descent. Things, just simple things like repairing things and cooking and how to build and how to grow food, all these huge diversity of issues. And so a big transition theme is the great reskilling. So for example, we've got a group called Stitch in Time, which was set up by one of our members who heard on the radio an interview with a woman who said that whenever her buttons fell off her children's shirts, she would throw them away and buy new ones. And Jenny was so horrified by this that firstly the waste in it, but secondly just it never occurred to her that someone might not know how to sew on a button. And so she set up this group, and lots of people come down to one of our more popular sessions and either bring a project that they want to do together or just come to learn skills or just come to be sociable. And so helping to facilitate the great reskilling. I'll skip one and come back to it, actually. And that ties in really nicely with the concept of honouring the elders, recognising that actually there are a lot of people who still have these skills who can pass them on but haven't really passed them on yet. And seeing that as a really strong community resource, and not just in terms of skills, but in terms of understanding. That in that period from the sort of 30s to the 60s when we were moving from oil scarcity to abundance, and also during the 70s when we had the oil shocks and everything that went with that, people who understand and remember that and know what community infrastructure there was before that maybe has been lost or maybe is lying dormant, and the understanding of things and using those insights to move forward, so combining those with the best new technologies and new social innovations and all the best of modernity, as well as remembering, you know, concepts like thrift that have sort of been lost. Step 9, which I skipped just to tie those together, is building bridges to local government, which I touched on before. That becomes crucial quite early, because obviously when you're looking at developing the community, they're one of the bodies that have a great say in that. And almost always we find that you're pushing on an open door. They're sort of, you'll have a transition meeting saying, oh, we should really engage with the local council, but we don't know how to do it. At the same time, the local council will be having a meeting saying, oh, we really want to engage with local people, but we don't know how to do it. So you just go and say, hi, you know, we're transition town, wherever, and we're really keen to, you know, push forward this. They say, come on in. And almost always, they're incredibly receptive to it. And usually there's some variant on the community development plan that they have, which you can tie into, and that ties into energy consent planning, which I'll talk about in a second. And step 11 is just a principle, really. Let it go where it wants to go. So don't feel like, you know, I started Transition Town wherever and I've got this vision that it's going to go here and anyone who disagrees with that is destroying the world. You know, we need to focus on the questions, not on the answers. So we need to say, here are the problems, here is the reality of it. Put those questions out there and then just step back and watch the collective genius of the community say, hey, I know how to do this and let's do that and why don't we? And suddenly it all starts happening and let it go, and things just seem to serendipitously fit together and work, whereas when you're trying to control it and really move it forward, it's exhausting and ineffective. It's the sense of unleashing the community rather than pushing anything, and any sense of control is illusory anyway. And then the final step in the 12-step model is what's called the Energy Descent Action Plan, and this is very critical. So the idea here is that you assess the current situation in your community, and then you say, okay, well, given climate change, given people, given these big scale things, within that context, what's our most positive, optimistic vision of what our community will look like in 20 years' time? Where do we want to be living in 20 years' time? What do we want it to be like? And then say, right, let's assume that's going to happen. If that's going to be what it's like in 2030, say, I don't know, all new homes are going to be built to local passive house standards, so built with local materials requiring no external heating, for example. That was one part of your 2030 vision. Well, if that's going to be in place in 2030, well, by 2028, we're going to have to educate all the local builders in how to do that. And by 2027, the local farmers are going to have to be growing the products that are required in order to do that, which means by 2025, we're going to have to be... And you do this process all the way back, step by step, until you get back to the present and think, oh, God, we've got to get started on this. And so deciding where we're going to get to and then backcasting from that is a really powerful part of the transition process. I won't have much time to talk about my book today, which I've got a few copies of, but that was part of the function of this, is providing a sort of backdrop to that process, because some of the local communities found when they were trying to do that they struggled because they needed to know about the large-scale issues which were going to affect them but which maybe they couldn't affect. So things like peak oil and climate change, but also government policy decisions, national food supply, you know, these big scale issues which Kingston on its own can't do much about. And so this, using the transition name, I was able to access loads of the top experts on these areas and pull together some really solid research and scenario planning around these issues as a resource for the local communities, a sort of framework within which to sit their local planning. And the idea is to integrate that with the local community plan if possible. In lots of places, the nascent Energy Descent Action Plans have actually been adopted by the local council as the plan for the community now. And building in resilience indicators to that, which is the idea of measurable things that you can test. For example, how much of our food is produced within a certain radius, or what percentage of businesses are locally owned, or whatever it might be in your community, ranging from the sort of serious to the silly in many cases. But having ways of measuring progress to see, you know, are we actually moving in the right direction or not, and then being able to challenge the obstacles to that, if those exist. I'm running low on time now, but some of the things that transition communities are up to, skill sharing, seeds going, sharing, producing local food directories, planting trees, energy saving advice, setting up locally owned renewable energy companies, setting up local currencies, working with local schools, car sharing schemes, permaculture courses, community supported agriculture schemes. Those are all actually from Tottenham Heath, just those examples. This is from every 2 months on Rob Hopkins' website, he puts out a roundup of stuff happening in transition. So he has these Google alerts set up alerting whenever anything happens with the word transition towns on anywhere on the internet. So we collect together all the various things that are happening. So just in the last 2 months, in the UK, Portobello has been running short courses in vegetable growing. Brixton's running a master gardener training course that's just started. Sevenoaks doing seedling swaps, advice on raising chickens and bees, a food hub. New Forest have got a new local food market set up. Had the great unleashings in Hebden Bridge in Malvern. Totnes produced its Energy Descent Action Plan, which is the first really substantial Energy Descent Action Plan produced anywhere in the world for a local community, which you can have a look at if you like. So masses going on, and then these are from other parts of the world. We've got a transition hub set up in Brussels, which is the idea that there are, within Brussels, smaller groups, but they have lots of common interests, so there's been a hub set up to support them. New initiatives in Germany, in America, San Francisco looking at starting a local currency, USTV featuring transition, Tasmania doing produce swapping and seed sharing events, community gardens set up in New Zealand. So this is going on all the time. It's just the last roundup, I could have picked any of them. This is the transition handbook, which was written by Rob Hopkins, who started off the whole thing. This basically lays out what transition is, and how it works in the 12 steps that I've just gone through. Then there was my book, The Transition Timeline, which fleshed out the transition vision a lot more and did that kind of research that I was talking about, looking at the sort of cultural stories and also looking at the history of food, energy, healthcare, population, etc. for the UK, and visioning how the next 20 years could pan out as a resource for those communities. And then we've got these transition guides, which are the new series. So local food was the first one. So these are produced by people in transition initiatives, sort of looking at principles that they can pull out from the experience of existing transition initiatives to help others who are coming along. Local Money just came out a few weeks ago. The next one's going to be a guide to working with your local council, and how you can do things if the national government are resistant to it. And to end up, I'd just like to say this, which I think sums up transition beautifully. So this is the peak oil curve that we were looking at. And you could say it's peak anything in a way. It's peak oil, it's the necessary peak in emissions, it's peak soil, it's peak everything, as we all know, with these complex interlocking problems. But the sort of traditional narrative around this is that we sort of started up down here and we've climbed our way up to this peak of achievement and ingenuity and human society at its very best, and we gazed out across the valleys and it was a beautiful thing. And now, oh my God, we're going to go tumbling down here and it's going to be terrible and awful, and we've really got to, you know, find some way to survive this awful future. And the transition approach is to flip that graph literally upside down and say, actually, it's more like there's this murky, dark pool of oil. And we were told that down at the bottom was this amazing treasure, this wonderful life and lifestyle that would be amazing and beautiful and delightful. So we dived down into this pool of oil seeking for this delightful, wonderful lifestyle. And we got down the bottom and we thought, actually, it's not that great. You know, we're using massive amounts of energy, sure, but, you know, we've got higher rates of mental illness, depression, suicide than we've ever had before, and we're destroying our global environment and borrowing from the future in a completely unsustainable way. And so actually, the second half, the descent curve, if you like, is more like swimming back up to the light, up to a natural way of living, up to a sense of community and well-being and health. And so that's the kind of transition approach, is to flip this on its head and say, actually, there's a lot that we've lost over the last couple of hundred years that we've really missed. I mean, particularly, I think a sense of community is a very strong thing. And so just to remind ourselves, that sort of sits at the local level, along with a myriad of other things. After a few questions, I think David's going to talk a bit more about the national and international context within which that sits. And so my website, Dog Optimism, which talks about this and all the other things that I'm up to. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we take a few questions now, and then David will talk very much more about the
you to interpret anything I say as being distracting. You know me well enough that anything I say, which may come across as very confrontational, is because we share the same vision and understanding of the changes that have got to be made.
Okay.
I must say, I'm astounded about the way in which, for instance, I empathise entirely with people working in the Transition Towns movement. But do they fondly imagine that this process, if it spreads and spreads across the planet, will be of a sufficient order to negate the need for a mandatory reduction in the demand for fossil fuels and the use of fossil fuels? It seems to me sort of so naive to believe that to be so. Now, that's not to say that I'm saying Transition Towns movement shouldn't be followed up, but the impression that is given by the Transition Towns movement is that we get to spread and spread, rather like a religion, so that we're all inspired, you know, on the same principle, if we all lay down our arms, there'll be no more wars. Surely you can accept that as a reasonable proposition. You know, it just doesn't work that way. And the problem is that anybody involved in the Transition Towns movement, if they respond to it in the only way they can, are obliged to live a near zero carbon, adopt a near zero carbon lifestyle. Otherwise, there's a very strong inbuilt level of hypocrisy into their actions. They may join the Transition Town movement, grow their own vegetables and so on and so on, but when summer comes up, off they go to fly on their summer holiday. That cannot be allowed to go on. And the changes that are essential for that not to go on require government intervention. So I don't go along with the proposition that this has got to be a groundswell of public opinion and public understanding. And so I think the opposite, it's got to come from on high, requiring everybody to do deliver their share of the problem. Otherwise, if it's on a voluntary basis, the implication is that there are lots of people, and there can be more and more people who are prepared to do so. But then, if we are to save the planet for in terms of its habitability, then there's an even bigger requirement on those who are prepared to commit themselves because of the people who aren't prepared to do so. So it seems to me it has got to be a global solution. And whilst you may, you did pour cold water on that, I think, well, we'll hear from David shortly on this. But can I just go on to another one or two? One more, because
okay.
It is fundamental thing. It's the whole concept of peak oil. We know perfectly well that it doesn't matter how much is left in the ground. We must not burn it. So to talk about peak oil implies that if we go on at the rate we are, we're going to run out of it. Well, we can't afford to wait for it to run out, number one. But even more important than that is the fact that we have totally factored out the claims of future generations on this finite reserve. It is morally outrageous that public policy and even most people involved in the movement should have overlooked that significant element, because once you accept that future generations have got a claim on this, then the logical route for policy is to stop using it, or get as quickly as possible to stop using it, not to reduce it less and less. So finish on this point. At the opening of your remarks, you talked about reducing demand as the key element. Totally agree with it. It was the theme of my doctoral thesis over 40 years ago, right at the heart of it, reducing demand. But it cannot be on a voluntary basis. Let's stop deceiving ourselves that that is the route.
I think we've got the message. Okay, thank you.
Sean. Well, I agree with all but one thing you've just said, and in fact, I think I said a lot of it myself, that we absolutely do need international and national frameworks to support and stimulate the local level stuff. And I'll say that isn't what I was talking about today, and David's, wherever he's gone, was going to talk about that. But absolutely, I think that techs are absolutely required, and they're a compulsory system for reducing our national dependence on energy and carbon, and I totally agree. The part that I don't agree with, when you say we can't rely on bottom-up, it has to be top-down, I think we absolutely need both, and that we can't see it as one or the other, that you need to have local level action, as I mentioned, because if you have top down and you don't have local level buy-in, it's just not going to work. But if you have local level action without top level buy-in, as I said before, you you just end up with nothing effective. So I think I mentioned that in terms of peak oil. Again, I said that we need to not see that as the limit of what we can do. We need to cut that slope much more steeply because of climate change. I don't agree with people who say peak oil is irrelevant because the trajectory required by climate change is steeper than the trajectory required by peak oil. It's absolutely true that the trajectory required by climate change is steeper than the availability of peak oil. We already have more than enough fossil fuel to push us into runaway climate change. We know that. That's very clear. But trying to address climate change in isolation without an awareness of peak oil leads to a great deal of very damaging outputs. And we have to be aware that actually, regardless of what we do, one thing that I didn't have time to go into peak oil or climate change in much detail, but one critical thing is net energy, the concept of energy return on energy invested, which for anyone who isn't aware is just the idea that to produce any energy you have to use energy. So building a solar panel requires energy, drilling an oil well requires energy. And so what's actually useful is the energy profit, it's the energy produced minus the energy used. And using historical figures on the reduction, because we used the easy good stuff first. So as time goes on, it takes more and more energy to get the energy out, and you're getting lower and lower quality oil, for example, which is highly sulfurous stuff or stuff that requires a great deal of refining. So both sides of that equation are getting worse. The energy costs of our energy are getting worse. The energy output of our energy sources is getting worse. And so the net energy, the energy profit, is declining rapidly. And the figures on that are that actually when you're at peak, this study was just looking at oil, but when you're at peak conventional oil gross, you've used about half of the oil, but you've actually used about 75% of the energy profit. And so the actual useful energy is only about a quarter of what's there. So it might be true that there's lots of stuff there, but it's less and less useful stuff. And it's a real challenge for climate policy to find how do we move to a lower carbon future in a world where we're massively energy constrained and massively money constrained. Like that makes the climate challenge much more difficult. And I think we do need to have an awareness of peak oil while we focus on climate change.
Okay, I've got two, three. But I would also like to say something here from a complexity theory perspective, because it answers your question directly. So from both a theoretical and an empirical point, we know that in order to address a complex problem, we need to address it at multiple scales. It is never enough to do it at one level or one scale. And only having top-down imposition, we know, does not work. Because what you need to, the top-down, what governments need to do, what legislation needs to do, is to provide some of the schemes that David will talk about, but also to provide the right infrastructure, the right training, the right skills, etc., etc. But we also need to encourage self-organization at a local level. Because once that self-organization actually takes place, it means that we have diversity of actually addressing the problem in different ways. We are exploring the space of possibilities. This is fundamental because there isn't a single solution to any complex problem. And therefore, we need to address the different ways of looking at the problem. And you can only do that at a local level. So we need self-organization and we need exploration of the space of possibilities. And once that happens, we then have the co-evolutionary dynamics, because as each group, each community actually takes action, it will affect those around them. They will change their behavior. It will come back and influence the first group. And that dynamic is very, very, very powerful. And I think the map you showed with a lot of groups actually setting up and the ripple effect of one community setting up and others growing around it, I think that's further evidence. So this is very, very, very quick overview from the theory. If you later on we can discuss it at greater depth, but I could not leave it without actually coming in and actually saying with the theoretical and the empirical evidence is there to argue for action at multiple levels at the same time. Okay, so one, two, and three. Thank you.
Milton Friedman
has said, which is that we don't do these things because we think they'll solve the problem now. We do them so that at the point of crisis, there will be a viable model for people to move to. And I think that part of the transition movement's success is that if you can make some examples of places where they've gotten their energy consumption down 25%, at the point where national mandates come in, there are working models which can then be scaled using the power of the state. I think that as a lowering the threshold of credibility of a lower energy future, they're very useful as pilot projects. And the second thing is that in a democracy, the ability to impose top-down regulation of energy demand is highly improbable at this point. I mean, there's a real issue here that, for example, one-child family probably cut the net environmental impact of the human race by about 2%, but that's not the kind of thing that you can do in a democratic society. So I think that part of the pivot here is that building political willingness in the general public is actually a necessary precondition to any kind of radical action imposed by state control. So yeah, I think it's justifiable from both perspectives.
Yeah.
Which was the question?
I think I'm probably to some extent agreeing with both of you. I mean, I think well, part of the beauty of transition is that it manages to take people with different perspectives and get them working together. So there are definitely people within transition who see themselves as putting into place an alternative infrastructure to catch people when the mainstream one fails. There are also definitely people who see themselves as trying to improve the mainstream infrastructure and make it more sustainable and more resilient. And I think it's actually a strength of transition that it has that diversity of perspectives underlying the work that's going on, and that those groups are able to work together. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, we do need to build the consensus. I mean, as you know, I do a lot of work around the national policy frameworks that are required, but without the groundswell of opinion, we're not getting anywhere.
And we've known the policy stuff for 30 years, it just hasn't moved. You know, if we're not going to get central control to do something, what's our alternative strategy?
Picking up on that first question about transition towns not achieving enough change or the necessary change, do you think transition towns are more about ideas and understanding rather than action? In other words, getting people to understand the issues so then the next step becomes more acceptable. That's not completely dismissing transition towns, but I'm interested to know what you think.
No. I mean, I think it's both. I think transition is explicitly both. I think it's... I think it would have... People would be a lot less interested in it if it wasn't... a process of doing things, and I think it very much is a process of local communities getting together and doing things. And even if they are insufficient to the scale of the problem in themselves, I think that there's a level. I think you sort of created a false dichotomy between understanding and doing. I think there's a level of understanding that you only gain through doing. And so by trying to explore these things and thinking, well, I understand this level of the problem, so I'm going to start engaging with it. And then engaging with it, you realise, oh, hang on, there's this bigger problem, and I need to step back and think about that, and then start engaging with that. It's a process we're all going through, gradually understanding more and more parts of the complex situation that we find ourselves in. So I think transition is really a process of educating and spreading ideas through doing, rather than trying to differentiate the two from each other.
Meanwhile, the accumulation of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere continues at an alarming rate. This is the problem, we don't have time.
No, well, this is the eternal discussion that all environmentalists continually have, is, hang on, you know, we need radical change, otherwise we're screwed. But we don't have time to wait for radical change, otherwise we're screwed. And there's this continual debate that all environmentalists have been having at 3 a.m. for 40 years, as you say.
I mean, the simple answer is that one of the nuclear powers issues a mandate, and then we see what happens, right? But by the time, but you know, that's the only way you can force this kind of thing, right? Somebody picks up the big gun and points it, right? Hi, we're the USA, you're going to cut your power consumption by 30%, we're going to nuke you. That's kind of what it would take to get some kind of unilateral consensus enforced globally. That's not going to happen. Nobody's willing to use a thermonuclear weapon over carbon yet, and until they are, they talk of a top-down mandate forming. You know, tell me when it happens, then we can talk.
There was an immediate acceptance in the beginning of the Second World War of the need for food rationing. There were no campaigns in Trafalgar Square saying, outrageous, let the market forces prevail. It was immediately accepted. The suggestion that we need time to persuade people to accept it on the principle of democracy, I think, flies in the face of the fact that in critical issues facing, and this one is the most critical of all time, facing the world. We have got to have government intervening, doing things, irrespective of whether the public is prepared to wear it or not.
But
it's
no,
a sad commentary.
There's no political will.
What?
There's no political will.
Exactly, exactly. So what, we let the planet go to pot because there is no political will, or we can't move until we have persuaded
Do you
people.
Have the power to give the government the political will it doesn't have? Because I don't know how to do that. If you know how to do it,
Gentlemen, I think we have one more question. Yes, sir.
Although the maps that are there at the moment looks fantastic, it seems to me that in any given point on that, in any given transition community, only represents a tiny fraction of the people in that area, in that town, in that village. And I mean, it was notable at the Transition Towns Conference that it was vastly white middle class. So there is sort of, there's a particular demographic attached to the transition movement at the moment. Is it possible for transition to spread more widely within those individual points on the map, particularly within sort of within ethnic groups and sort of in terms of demographics?
Well, I think both the point Vina and Mayor are discussing and your point are exactly what I'm working on right now. I mean, with regard to your stuff, I think that the crucial difference from the 1940s and 30s is that our cultural narratives are massively different now. We have a really different sense of who we are and what's important, and that isn't allowing these things to happen, and that looking at how those stories have shifted and how maybe they can shift again is a real interest of mine, although not what I was particularly talking about today. In answer to your question, I think yes, that again, that's something I'm really working on. I mean, in Kingston, we're doing a lot of work at the moment with a group called the Cambridge Road Estates Community Group, because actually on the edge of Kingston we have two of the highest crime rate council estates in London. And so we're working with them at the moment to develop community growing programs within those estates. And they're extremely enthusiastic. And their only fear is that they say, or rather the people who live there say to them, yeah, we've heard it all before. The government comes in with some scheme and they say, yeah, it's great, we're going to really support you to do this. And it happens for 6 months and then the funding goes and everyone wanders away and it disappears. So they're quite excited by the fact that they've realised this isn't funded by anyone and we're not doing it because we're being paid by someone and then we'll go away when it happens that we're actually doing this. So they've given us a tiny crack in the door to say, maybe we'll give you a chance to win our trust.
I think it's really a tipping point there in terms of whether we can get these.
Definitely. But also I think, we've got a new diversity coordinator just appointed at the Transition Network who's, explicitly looking at these issues. But we also have to remember, I think the figure is something like 95% of the people in this country are white. And, so if 95% of the people involved with transition in this country are white, that's not entirely not to be expected. And in London, it's much more diverse, and in other places, much less so. So, and I think we're very good on gender diversity, we're very good on age diversity. So I think it's, although it's something we are very aware of and we're working on, I think it's almost a sort of overdone.
Income as well,
middle
class as well. It's about
Yeah, I mean, the problem there usually with the working class people that I've spoken to is that they don't have any time. And the upper class people that I speak to don't seem to have, the vast majority don't have that much excitement in engaging with this stuff because they see themselves as sort of living in a separate world from the rest of us. But certainly at the working class level, it's the time issue. I mean, that's the great flaw in the sort of big society idea of the Conservatives is that, they hope to sort of step back and let other people step into the breach, but they're also taking away all ability that people have to not work full time. So.
Okay, I'll take the last two questions together, and then, David, if that's all right, we'll have a 10-minute break for tea because it's here, and then we'll start with your presentation. So, sir, over there, yes, if you.
Thank you. I've noticed on your maps the dots are planted mainly in the first world of the Belt world.
Sorry, say that again?
The dots.
Oh, yeah.
Coverage
yeah.
of the transitions are covered mainly in the Belt world.
Yeah.
I personally believe there's an explanation for that and probably want to expand that. And the second part of my question was how the other part of the society, which is very energy-phobic, the business, is part of your...
Energy-phobic, did you say?
Sorry?
Energy-phobic?
Yeah.
Meaning?
Consuming a lot of energy.
Right.
So it's... how is that part of your balance of...
So the developing world and business?
Yeah.
constituencies also. So and I'll take your question as well, and then Sean can.
I just wanted to say that I helped write the diversity strategy for transition, and I helped get the diversity worker into transition.
Great.
And transition and the period we're living through now, of course, opens up all these questions about social equity and social justice and how do you share resources. And I think this is a huge opportunity, in fact. And transition diversity is engaging different faith groups, with different income groups, with different ethnic groups, and it sees this need for diversity as being a key part of resilience. That's all I wanted to say.
Great, thank you very much. So, do you want to?
Yeah. Well, in terms of your sort of semi-question about the balance between emissions from organisations and households, it's roughly 50-50, give or take, you know, organisations as opposed to households. In terms of business engagement with transition, there's a lot of it about. One of the main ways that we're doing it is through a process called oil vulnerability audits, which is basically going to businesses and saying, you know, let's look at your business model and see what that looks like in a world where the oil price is $150 a barrel or whatever. And that is, we've found to be a really great way of engaging with business, because they say, oh, yeah, I've never asked that question, or at least they did a few years ago, and now maybe they're starting to think about it. And then doing some work with them to examine, you know, how their business model is made vulnerable and their profits are threatened by the big scale issues that we were just talking about, and similarly, you know, vulnerability to you know, variations in local climate and issues like that. So that's been one of our big ways. And of course, there's lots of, the beauty of transition is it's a diverse thing. We don't say, here's a solution, everyone go out and apply it, this is what works. It's a set of principles that are applied. So there's a massive diversity of approaches. I mean, in Kingston, we've got a business action group who do a lot of, they've done a few competitions around, you know, new ideas from businesses about how to make themselves greener. There's this thing called carrot mobbing, I think it's called, which is where people go around to all of a particular, so say go to all the convenience stores in the local area, ask them about, you know, what green project would you do if I could bring you an extra 10% of business? And they say, oh, well, I'd do this and I'd do that. And whichever one presents the most ambitious plans for greening their project, they then guarantee that all of the people involved in the carrot mob will then shop exclusively there for the next year. So it's a way of encouraging, you know, green development. So there's a huge diversity of ways that businesses engage. I would say that it's an area that needs a lot more development. I would think that transition has so far most appealed to communities, but all the same questions apply to business, of course. Business is not immune from peak oil, it's not immune from climate change, it's certainly not immune from economic contraction. So the idea is to absolutely get that part of the community involved in the discussion, and that is happening to an extent, but I think certainly can continue to strengthen. In terms of areas of the world, I showed these slides as you picked up, because those are the areas that have most sort of taken transition and run with it, and I think that's inevitable, because in the same way that in the UK we've discovered real differences between urban and rural contexts, and we had a really interesting workshop at the conference a few weeks ago about the Totnes EDAP. Totnes is a market town in Devon, and talking about how applicable that process is to somewhere like Nottingham in particular, we were looking at, and how that differs. Obviously, the process of transitioning from our current way of life to one that makes sense in the world that we're moving into is going to look radically different somewhere like the UK than it's going to look somewhere like Ethiopia. And so it's inevitable, I think, that the processes that we've managed to work out here immediately appeal to these people. But the idea is that we're trying to uncover the principles which can be applied in a wide diversity of contexts. And that is starting to apply. I mean, as I say, one of the most interesting talks at Transition Conference was by these 8 Brazilian women who came over, who were talking about the work that they're doing in the favelas in Brazil, working with those people around these issues. And they were saying that, you know, 3 years ago, nobody there had heard of climate change. It was completely off the radar. And now, because of actual local changes in their weather systems there, in particular things like their water supply being not becoming short, because they've got an awful lot of water there, but being disrupted, and also the burning of the Amazon, the large areas of the Amazon are burning because it's much drier than it used to be. These are really waking people up, and so I think it's inevitable as climate change and peak oil are shaping our future so dramatically that it's inevitable that almost everyone is going to be affected by them. And then they start to ask, well, what are we going to do about it? And that's all that transition is. It's a conversation about what do we do about these things. And it started with a certain group of people in Totnes, and it will look massively different in a group of people in Ethiopia or wherever else. But it's, I mean, it doesn't really matter whether the conversation happens under the name of transition or something else. The important thing is that the conversations are happening and that people are starting to address the issues.
That point, no, I think we need to stop, otherwise David is not going to have enough time for his presentation. We do have tea here, so can I just ask you just 10 minutes to get some tea and go to the loo? The loos are on the fourth floor. There is a restaurant up there, and there are plenty of them in the middle. If your name is not on the list and you would like us to keep you informed of future seminars, I will circulate one of those lists. If you like to add your name and your email, then we'll keep you informed. Otherwise, Sean, thank you very much indeed. And quick tea, loose, and then we'll be ready for David.